Welcome to the West Harlem Way Race Podcasts. I'm John Kinniston, and this is episode 49. Welcome back to the West Harlem Way Race Podcasts. I had decided to wait until November to do the next one, but I've arranged an interview with John Vernon, but he couldn't. He wasn't around to do that until early November, so I thought, oh well, I can squeeze another one in, I thought. And then Alan Stewart got in touch with me and said that he would be willing to read out his race report. I think in the last podcast I'd ask if anyone would like to do that, if they would volunteer to read out their report, and I would put it on, and Alan very kindly did that. So that's the first main item of this podcast. Alan finished the 2013 race. That was the first time he'd done the West Harlem Way, and he finished in 135th place in a time of 31 hours, 42 minutes and 33 seconds. And his report is well worth listening to. Someone who was out there for that length of time has obviously got lots of stories to tell, so it was great. And hopefully for people who are thinking about doing the race, then that will be really helpful for them as well, just to get a feel of what it's like to be running for that long. And then the second item we've got for this podcast is an idea which I thought I'd do, and I got in touch with Dave Troman to ask whether he'd be willing to share some of his training tips. I know Dave pretty well over the last few years. We've done a lot of training together. Last year we ran the Lakeland race, the Lakeland 100, and we recce'd the course over four runs, each of about 30 odd miles each time. So I got to know Dave pretty well. I mean, must have chatted most of the time, the whole way round of that route. And I think Dave's someone who I respect a lot from the way that he prepares for races and the way he goes about things. As you'll see from the interview, you get a bit of a feel of his background in running. And certainly in the last few years, as he's got involved in the ultras, it's been really interesting to see the way he's prepared for them. And I think he's got his best out of himself in the races, particularly the last couple of years. In 2012, he did the Highland Fling in 9:18, and then followed that up with the Lakeland 100, where he came 10th overall in a time of 25, 52, 24. And then this year, he had an even better fling, finished in 8 hours, 56, 10, for 21st place overall. And then the West Harlem Way, he improved his time from 2010, where he ran 18 hours, 30 minutes, 59. And then his final big race of this year was the Ring of Fire, which was a three-day event, where his overall time was 25 hours, 37 minutes, and he finished seventh overall in that one. That's 131 miles over the 3 days. But a thing I really like chatting with Dave about is the way he prepares for races. If he's going to do the West Harlem Way, he prepares in one way. If he's doing the Lakeland race, it's a different type of preparation. And I think he's got a lot to just chat through. Like all these things, there's no right way of training, there's no wrong way of training in a sense, but I think there are some principles there, and hopefully that's what I'd like to bring out in chatting with Dave about some of the principles that he feels are important for preparing to run the West Harlem Way race, a 95 mile race up and down lots of hills. So they're the two items, Alan Stewart's race report and my interview and chat with Dave Troman, and some ideas about training. And the one with Dave, we're going to do that regularly, maybe once every couple of months, and we'll intersperse those throughout the podcasts just to get some thoughts, and we'll look at different aspects of training each time we chat together. Well, the entries are open in 2 weeks' time. I'm recording this on Thursday the 17th of October 2013. And so 2 weeks tomorrow will be the 1st of December, and the 1st of November, and the entries will open. Now remember, you've got the whole of November to enter. It's not first come, first serve. All the details are on the website, westharlemwayrace.org. And if you click on the little tab entry, and Ian, the director, has spelt out there exactly how we go about that. Basically, we've said that there's an entry limit of 200 runners on the race day, but we'll be looking to accept 265, because past experience has shown there's a withdrawal rate of at least 25% prior to race day. And the way that that's worked out, I say, have a look at the website and you'll be able to see just how that's allocated. And basically, if there are more than 265, then there will be a ballot, and there will be to be able to work that out. I'm just looking at the details there. Yeah, if there are too many fully qualified entrants for the number of places available, a ballot will take place to allocate the balance of starting places. The race director will try to allocate up to 25% of the available places to those who have not started the race before. So it's all clear there. But if you are thinking of entering the race, and I hope you are, then do have a look at the website, and the details of how that works from the 1st of November will also be on there just a few days before. Basically, we're using SI Entries this year because they're the company that we use for the timing chips, so it makes sense to go with them as well for the entries. So if you are looking to enter this year, I wish you all the best in the entry process. But remember, you've got the whole of November. You don't have to enter on midnight on the 1st of December. There's 1st of November. You've got plenty of time to be able to get your entry in. So this podcast is Alan Stewart's Race Report, followed by my chat with Dave Trowman, thinking about preparing and training for the West Harlem Way Race.
The Journey to West Highland Way 2013 by Alan Stewart. The Journey to the West Highland Way race 2013 started immediately after last year's fling. Previously, I'd always decided I would leave it for a few years before applying for the big one. You know, get a few flings under my belt first. My thinking changed soon after completing my first fling in 2012, after coming to the conclusion if I can run 53 miles, then I should be able to grind out another 40 odd. In this sport of ours, injuries can be just around the corner, and I figured, why leave it for a few years when anything could happen injury-wise? Strike while the iron's hot, as they say. In November, entries opened, and I eagerly completed my application form and awaited the ballot result. One early December evening, Tommy phoned. "Did you get in then?" he asked. Quickly, I fired up my iPhone in excitement to check my emails. Seconds later, my heart sunk. I was one of 15 people polled out due to an oversubscription. I was gutted. However, I tried to console myself with the fact I had next year and was still going to be part of Tommy's support crew, so I wasn't completely missing out. Ian Beattie, the race director, called me the next day to say how he realised how disappointed I would be, which I thought was a really nice gesture of him. Over the months leading up to June, I kept training hard, including many big hill runs, including the Pentland Skyline. In March and May, I completed both the D33 and Fling Again respectively. About 3 weeks before the West Highland Way race, the mobile phone rang late on Friday evening. It was Ian Beattie, the race director, who tells me due to a considerable number of people pulling out, he could now offer me a place, but did appreciate, as it was only a few weeks away, I may not be prepared. I asked Ian if I could have until the morning to think about it. I immediately phoned Tommy, and his response was, "You're definitely doing it, you will only regret it if you didn't." A point I found hard to disagree with. That was it, I was in with 3 weeks to prepare. Needless to say, every waking second was spent thinking about the task that lay ahead. Tommy's crew was to be Roy, his friend, and Jamie, his son, with Ian and Paul supporting me. We had a final meet-up a week before and knew what we had to do. Before long, Friday the 21st arrived, which I had taken off work to try and grab some sleep beforehand. Needless to say, by the time I had finished all my prep, I had just a few hours before picking Ava, my daughter, up from a friend's house. Ian arrived at 9:30 PM, and after loading the car, we set off for Mulgai, meeting Roy, Tommy and Paul there. As we neared Mulgai, as forecast, a light rain started. Before long, we pulled into the railway station car park, spotted the lads and parked next to them, and we all sat in Roy's van for a bit, with plenty of light-hearted banter keeping the mood happy. I was conscious of constantly yawning, wondering how on earth I could run for 30 plus hours feeling like this. I walked up to the church, registered and had a chat with a few of my friends and fellow runners before returning to the other lads to make my final preparations. At 12:30, Ian Beattie read out the race details, including a lovely verse by Wace Helland Wee veteran and lovely lady Fiona Rennie. Final preps made, we bid our farewells to the lads, telling them we would see them in about 4 hours at Balmaha. At precise 1 a.m. the horn blew and we were off. It was a wonderful sight running up through the centre of Mulgai, with the streets lined with people, all taking photos and shouting encouragement to the passing runners. It really seemed like the entire population of Mulgai, including all the punters on their way home from the pub, had turned out to wave us off. It was lovely to hear Debbie Kinsani and Sharon Law scream encouragement to us all. I mean, these two girls are world-renowned athletes, and here they were to voice their support to everybody. The first few miles were spent surrounded by other runners, but before long the pack thinned and Tommy and I were running side by side with very few people around us. We chatted and just savoured the experience. As the rain got heavier, I put up my hood, and as I ran along following the beam of light, it almost felt like I was inside some kind of vehicle and was merely a passenger. Before long, we were climbing the grassy field towards Drimmen, 12 miles in. As we crossed the road, we spotted the lads and shouted hello to them. We pushed on, maintaining a steady pace, being very careful not to go too fast. For me, the West Highland Way race doesn't really start until you're on the path to Connick. By this time it was starting to get light, of which we were very grateful. The climb up and over Connick passed without any problems. I have to say, since they've laid paths and stairs down the other side, it's made it a bit easier. Some people argue it's lost some of the charm and challenge, but I see it as a good thing, as it's now made it more accessible for people to climb and take in the beautiful views of the loch below. We hit Balmaha at 4:23, quickly spotted the crew, then sat down for some food. I had some hot pasta, a cup of tea and a yoghurt, which went down very well. With 10 minutes gone, Tommy and I set back off down the trail. The climb from Balmaha is always quite tough, though nothing compared to what lay ahead. As we weaved our way along towards our denning, we caught up with about 8 other runners and all took it upon ourselves to take a turn at being leader. As we rang along, there was a tourist tour boat travelling in the same direction. At one point, the tourist guide commented on the runners running in the West Highland Way race, followed by cheers and waves from the passengers. We all returned the cheers, whoops and waves. Following about a dozen, someone must have stolen River Denning comments from Tommy, we reached River Denning in 6:37 and fueled up from our drop bags. Again, we kept the stop to a minimum and set off again. The climbing and descending along the banks of Loch Lomond is quite tough, especially as you have to watch each and every step to avoid falling in the water. We dug deep and kept running all the flat and downhills and walking uphill strategy going until eventually arriving at the second and final unsupported checkpoint, Inversnaid. As I fueled up, I was set upon by a billion midges, so we decided to make our stay short once again and walk while eating. We continued to make good progress, passing Dario's post, reaching Beanglass Farm in 11:01. The only downer was the lads had been unable to park close to the checkpoint, meaning we had to walk a couple of hundred yards to the supply vehicles. Both Tommy and I decided as we approached Beanglass we were going to ditch the jackets, as the last few hours had turned quite warm with the rain subsiding. As luck would have it, as soon as we sat down the rain started back up very heavily. At this point, I should note, one of the other support teams asked if we could jumpstart his vehicle, which Ian duly obliged. Later, a second vehicle asked for the same favour, Ian duly obliged. When Ian went to start the car, the battery was dead and required Roy to jumpstart him. Hydrated and fed with the jacket still on, we set off once more towards Greenlarach. As we hit Derrydarach Farm, I was surprised at how clean the area was. This is known to rowers as Cowpat Valley, due to the huge amount of cow dung due to this part of the way going through a working farm. During the fling the month before, this area was knee-deep in mud and whatnot, which made it very heavy underfoot. After negotiating this, we were soon under the small tunnel and on our way towards Ewich Forest, which, although very pretty and soft underfoot, there are a lot of very steep climbs, most of which seem to go on and on. Running the flats and downhill and walking up hills, it wasn't long before we hit Auchentire Farm. This is one of the 3 times each runner is weighed to ensure he or she does not suffer any dramatic weight loss or gain. I had lost 1.2 kilograms and Tommy a bit more. We made our goodbyes and set off towards Tindrum. As I neared Tindrum, thoughts turned to thinking had this been the fling, I would only have a few minutes left to run, but today this would still be another 40 plus miles left. As we headed up the hill and across the road and past the little shop on the left, Paul, our support runner, joined us. Both Tommy and I were feeling pretty good at this stage, but were glad to have someone else for company, as conversation between Tommy and I had disintegrated into merely complaining about our ailments. This is quite a pleasant, very runnable section, and it wasn't long before we began the long descent in towards Bridge of Forky. Paul remarked how surprised he was given the running pace we were maintaining. When we arrived, the crew were nowhere to be seen. Shortly after, the guys appeared with nothing prepared. Apparently, when Paul had phoned ahead to make them aware of our impending arrival, we had arrived sooner rather than they anticipated. We decided we didn't want to hang around, so set off up the hill and we'd meet the guys on the other side. Ian commented he would see us in 20 minutes or so. Tommy quipped, 20 minutes, it's a mountain we've got to climb first. We set off up the hill. After what seemed like an hour or so of running, walking, we began our descent downhill and could see the lads parked up below in the distance. Paul ran ahead to make them aware of our soon arrival. This was the first time since starting out that I think both Tommy and I had started to become aware of really sore feet, blisters. Before long, we were down from the hill and sat down for a welcome 10-minute break food session. Tommy at this point was feeling quite sickly and took a couple of paracetamol to try and settle himself. I asked Paul to take a look at my feet. Upon removing my shoes, I could see the formation of quite a few large blisters. Paul dried my feet off, applied talcum powder and a few blister plasters. I also decided to swap from my road shoes to the trail shoes. We set off once again and I was delighted to report my feet felt a bit better. Tommy in the meantime seemed to have recovered from feeling quite unwell and had become what I can only describe as a coiled spring full of running. We were now in Rannoch Moor section, which is an old military road which seems to go on for miles. Underfoot wise it doesn't seem too bad, but on sore feet the little stones make for quite a painful journey. The only respite is trying to run along the odd little patch of grass at the side. This section seemed to take a particularly long time, given it seems very straight and very long. The weather though at this point was quite pleasant, which was a bonus as this area is normally quite hostile on a cold day given how high up and exposed it is. As we reached our checkpoint at Glencoe, Paul once again took off to make the guys aware of our impending arrival. Before long we reached the chairlift car park in Glencoe. As I made my way to the vehicles, my feet were really getting sore by the minute. At this point it was getting dark and I knew within half an hour I would be entering my second night of running in the dark. I had been warned by various people who ran the race before that this is where it gets really tough mentally for those still running. Oddly, this aspect never really bothered me as I still knew the task in hand and was determined to get there by hook or by crook. Fed and watered, we started on back down the road towards King House Hotel. As we trotted down, Paul made us aware there was a runner, John, who had asked if he could run with us as his support runner was struggling. Paul agreed, albeit making him aware he had to stick with our pace. Tommy, Paul, John and I kicked on, and before long we reached the foot of the Devil's Staircase. This ascent is famously the most dreaded section of the West Highland Way, though friends who know the route reckon it's hard but not the hardest section. I believe you start the climb 800 feet above sea level and climb about another 1,000 feet to the top where it flattens out before eventually dropping you into Kinlochleven. As we began our ascent, the darkness had completely enveloped us and it was indeed quite surreal climbing a mountain in the heavy rain at midnight with only a beam of light for company. Tommy at this point, still possessing more energy than Tigger the Tiger, had pressed on and disappeared from sight. As we continued the climb, we passed a couple of runners. One guy had run out of steam and was just recharging. It struck me then how I was grateful to have Paul and John with me, as this was a dangerous place to be alone. A slip, trip, fall or anything else up here on your own and you probably wouldn't survive the night. It is a stunningly beautiful but ultimately deadly landscape if you don't give it the utmost respect. Finally reaching the top, we continued along until eventually beginning a long descent along a forest trail which winds its way down into Kinlochleven. As we neared the leisure centre, I was relieved as I now knew the next checkpoint was the finish. On arrival, I was weighed then sat down for some food and a cup of tea. Tommy had arrived about 10 minutes before, having got a bit lost coming down from Kinlochleven. he was set to go and asked if I could hurry as he wanted away. I told him I wanted to take 10 minutes and said that due to the blisters on my feet, there was probably going to be no more running by myself, and if he wanted to go in himself with Jamie and Roy supporting, he could. He decided that was for best. That was for the best, so he, Jamie and Roy left for the final stage. As I sat while Paul and Ian sorted some stuff, I was feeling very relaxed, knowing I only had one more section left and didn't feel in any rush to get going. I realised though that the quicker we set out, the quicker we would reach Fort William. I wakened John, who had taken an opportunity to close his eyes. Bidding farewell to Ian, who was now on his own, we left the centre and made our way towards a steep climb out of Kinlochleven. Spirits were high, with a lot of chatting helping to take our mind away from the task in hand. The climb itself wasn't too bad, but once you're at the top, you're met with a very rough trail littered with streams, boulders, stones, etc., making for a very painful walk run. As we continued on, a gap started to appear behind us, John in front, me in the middle, and Paul taking up the rear. As John had already completed the race 10 times previously, it was difficult to not want to keep asking how far it was. As we marched on, I was aware of Paul lagging behind a little. I stopped and shouted back, asking if he was okay. He replied he was feeling awful. I slowed up and let him catch up. He said he didn't think he could get to Fort William, and did I mind if he hitched a lift back to Fort William when we met John's crew at Llandavra. Both John and I said this wouldn't be a problem. We pressed on as quickly as we could, with the only talking being Paul inquiring as to how far John's crew would be. At one point, it was just behind these trees over there, followed by, no, just behind that hill, then round the corner half an hour later. Further on, we could make out the dark shape of someone coming towards us. When he reached us, it was a chap called Jeff, I believe from a mountain rescue. He insisted on taking our photo, as had become a tradition with him in every West Highland Way race. Paul inquired how far to Llandavra. Jeff reckoned about a mile and a half. We continued on for what seemed like an hour, with Paul remarking, "It's it. Longest mile and a half I've ever done." Eventually we spied what looked like a couple of people ahead. As we neared, we reached the point known as Llandavra. Two marshals had built what was earlier a fire and had been blasting out tunes for passing runners. Obviously, by the time we reached them, the fire was now just a pile of ashes and the batteries in their ghetto blasts are long dead. John updated his crew about giving Paul a lift back to Fort William. We made our goodbyes and carried on with yet another big climb. I noticed at this point, if I stopped and stood still, I felt a little off balance and tired, but it was fine if I kept moving. I also noticed my hands were so swollen to the point I was unable to make a fist, as the skin was so pulled so tight. They resembled hands from a long dead corpse. We pressed on and after an hour or so, reached a forest not entirely dissimilar to Ewich, with plenty of ups and downs. John is a teacher and has been running for many years, and I was grateful and very interested in listening to all his advice and stories, which helped take my mind off the hot needles being pushed into my feet with every step. At long last, we reached the top of Glen Nevis, a section I remember very well from 2 years previous when I acted as a support runner for Mike Raffin in his first ever West Highland Way race. It's a trail of hard-packed clay and stone and is very runnable, though sadly my feet weren't in any shape to take advantage of this. The track winds round and round, gradually descending into Fort William. It seemed every turn was followed by yet another long straight and another turn. As I looked to the right, I could see Fort William looming closer and closer. Eventually, we reached the bottom, turning left towards the Braveheart car park. I knew then the challenge was soon to be over. The road leading into Fort William was considerably longer than I had remembered, but then 2 years ago I was running at this point and never had broken feet. Before too long, we saw the sign into the left for the leisure centre. I told John we would sprint to the end. As we turned left, we picked up the pace and kicked on to the end, crossing under the finishing post. I'd done it, finishing in 31 hours and 42 minutes. In all the excitement talking to Ian Beattie, he told me the clock was still running, as I hadn't clocked off yet. Once clocking off, I stood under the West Highland Way race map for a photo and promptly broke down in tears. The emotions of the last 6 months, and especially the last 2 days, had taken their toll. It was part relief and part joy at finishing. I entered the centre and was greeted by all the lads. Tommy had finished in 31 hours and 3 minutes. After a very painful shower due to the inability to walk due to the blisters, we made our way to McDonald's for a spot of breakfast before going to the award ceremony to pick up the coveted goblet. The weekend was sealed off having a curry, followed by recounting stories with all the other runners in the pub across the road, a fitting end to a fantastic weekend. 2 weeks on, I've already started making plans how to get a couple of hours off next year's time. Hopefully I'll get in. Thanks to Ian Beattie and all his team of wonderful people. Without such, we wouldn't have had this experience. I'd also like to especially thank all the lads, Ian, Paul, Roy and Jamie. I couldn't have done it without you lot. Finally, thanks to Tommy. You said we'd do it and we did.
I've been joined by Dave Trollman tonight. Dave's sitting in his nice new house in Keswick, and we're doing this over Skype. And thanks for doing this for us, Dave. And first of all, maybe if you could just give us a little bit of background about your running and what you've done over the last however many years.
I've done a lot of years. I'm running and training competitively probably since about the age of 16, and I'm 45 now, so it's been quite a few years. I started off as a footballer, and then I got injured and I got into orienteering through my stepfather, who sort of persuaded me to go along with him. He'd always done orienteering, so I went along with him and got really into that. Competed at a very high level eventually in orienteering.
Okay, don't be modest. What's a high level?
I was a Great Britain International orienteer for a number of years.
Excellent.
And then sort of moving up into Cumbria, obviously I started getting into fell racing, which seemed like a sort of natural thing to do when you're up here. You don't really have a lot of choice, to be honest. And then I started combining the two of those together. So I started doing the kind of two-day mountain marathons, where you're self-sufficient on the hills for that length of time, navigating your way over the mountains. And then basically I got into ultra running simply because a friend of mine who was doing the West Island Way asked me along if I wanted to go and do some training with him. So we bombed up to the route, and we ran from Balmahar up to Tyndrum, and I just had a whale of a time. I arrived back in Keswick that following evening and entered the Highland Sling there and then, and the rest they kind of say is history. Here I am.
Yeah, and you've done the West Highland Way twice.
Yeah, I did 2010. So I did the Highland Sling in 2009 and finished that and thought, oh, that was amazing. I was in bits, but obviously then the seed was there after I got to do the full race. So I did the full race, which was my first basically 100-mile race in 2010. And then I did it again this year, 2013.
Yep, I've got your times here. In 2010, you took 20 hours, 20 minutes and 59 seconds. And then this year you shattered that and was 18 hours, 30 minutes and 59. So quite a big improvement from the 2 years.
Yeah, yeah. I think a lot of the improvement was, partly it was confidence. I knew I could do it. There was no longer this, will I get round or won't I get round. I actually had much more of a kind of, I think racing head on is maybe a bit of a strong phrase, but I was definitely felt a lot more competitive this time than I was last time. Last time I wanted to get round and do as good a time as I could, but this time I was more interested in what pace I could run the actual race over.
Yeah. Now, the reason I've asked you to take part in these podcasts, Dave, because I know from last year when we trained for the Lakeland race together, we did a lot of recce runs and we talked a lot about training and about pacing and the rest, and I just thought the way you prepared for your big races, particularly the Lakeland 100 last year and the West Highland Way race this year, I think you've got a lot to pass on, really, and a lot of good ideas. But I know you are doing a little bit of coaching, aren't you, with some of your colleagues? So could you tell us just a little bit about how that works?
I think probably advising rather than coaching. They come to me when they want a bit of a plan for the next sort of, you know, a couple of months and what they're aiming to try and do and what they should be doing and what they shouldn't be doing. And I've got a few colleagues who are just sort of trying to run their first 5 kilometres. I've got a couple of other guys who are racing quite competitively in the sort of Lakeland trail races, off-road, you know, to marathon distances off-road. And all I'm doing is trying to pass on my same, my sort of series of what works for me, really, and try and adapt it to what they need to do. And one of them, the sort of the best of the runners, actually came to me the day, and he just said, "It's amazing how I'm actually running less than I used to, but I'm running a lot faster than I used to," which is kind of, I suppose that's what really matters. It doesn't matter what your training diary says. It's actually what matters is what it says on the result sheet. So there's more than one way to skin a cat.
Yeah, and your full-time job is a PE teacher, isn't it? So you're used to motivating, encouraging pupils?
Sympathy. I'm not like an old-school PE teacher.
Yeah. Well, you're certainly working by example, aren't you?
Yeah, hopefully. If they see me do it, then they think, well, maybe there is something in there.
Yeah. Okay, Dave. So we've what I want to do for this first one on thinking about training tips, really, and some ideas, is to think about maybe some people who have or would like to enter the West Highland Way race. The entries start open in a couple of weeks, and they'll be open for November. And there'll be a good number of people who have not done that distance before. They'll have hoped they'll have done the Fling or the Devils or something similar. But the race is 8 months away. So I just wanted you to get some thoughts from you about how you would go about preparing for a race that's 8 months away. And then, you know, should you be straight in there doing big mileage or what? What are some of the principles that you would think about for yourself and if you were advising someone doing the race for the first time?
When we were talking just before we started now, John, one of the big problems we've had, I've had it in the past, I feel that you've certainly had it in the past, John, is that it's really easy to get fit quite quickly. You know, in the middle of February or the middle of March, you could be really ready for the race, but that's no good because you've then got to hang on to that fitness for another 2 or 3 months, which you can't do. So the slow and steady build up is the way to go. You want to be at your best towards the end of June, not in the middle of March or April. So one thing that I do, and I know one or two other people have written about it on their own blogs actually, I feel that you have to have a break before you start. So whatever you've done previously, when you're all full of enthusiasm, you've just sent your entry off, or you've just heard that you've got your entry and you want to go out and run and start blasting the train and that, it's definitely not the way to go. Take stock of things, have a bit of a rest, so that when you do start training, all the niggles have gone, you're chomping at the bit to get started, but you're giving yourself time to plan ahead, sort out when you're going to go up onto the route and have a look, sort out the accommodation and that. Do all that stuff before you get into the heat of battle to do the really hard training. I mean, although I'm doing it slightly different this year because I've got different aims for next year, when I've done the West Highland Way, I've taken the whole of November off from running. If I feel like, if I'm absolutely dying to go out, I'll go and run 3 miles and just get it out of my system, take half an hour over it, really slow. So basically come the end of November, I know I haven't got any injuries, I'm really ready to get started. I've probably planned some of what I'm going to do, I've booked some accommodation, whatever it happens to be, get everything in place, but don't start hammering it yet. Then, and this is my own personal thing, and this may not work for everybody, and please feel free to ignore this one, but for the first 2 months of training, so that would be kind of going into December and through January, I just have a rule that I stick to absolutely solidly, that I don't allow myself to run faster than a certain pace at any time in training. And the idea is to make sure I run slow, make sure everything's really easy. I can build up the mileage without worrying. You can't build up distance and speed at the same time. That's a really bad combination. You can do one or the other, but not both. And at that time of year, all I want to do is slowly build up some miles. So I don't do any road running at all. I only run off road, but I just set myself a pace limit of 8 minute miling. So even if I'm running on the road from the house to go out onto the fells or whatever, I look down at my watch and if it says I'm running at 7:50 minute mile pace, I just slow down. And it's great because if you're not feeling great before you go out after a day at work or first thing in the morning, if you're not feeling good, then you can use that as a kind of almost like an excuse to just keep going slower and going slower, and you can just build up. Once you get going, you're absolutely fine. But it's quite hard to stick to that, especially by the end of January, because by then you've built up a good level of fitness. You want to start running fast, but then it means coming in the February, right? It's like having the brakes taken off, and you can really do something from that moment onwards. But that 2 month build up, I think, is really important.
Yeah, and then from February onwards, then you start into really, you'd say that's the main part of your training.
Yeah, I'll go through February and March. Surprising, so a race in June, February and March are probably my two most important months, because then I'll start to do a little bit more hill work. I'll certainly start to do tempo. Now that I've switched to doing ultra run, I don't do any interval training anymore, but I've started to do more and more tempo work. And if I look down my watch and I'm running at 7.5 minute mile in, that's great, just go with it. Whereas before I would have slowed down, and it's just quite liberating to just have those kind of shackles taken off. And the idea is that through February and March, and into the beginning of April, then I'll start thinking perhaps more about the Highland Sling, which, again, some people don't want to do the Highland Sling only 8 weeks before the West Arnhem Way. I always have done it before the West Arnhem Way, partly because it gives a nice focus a little bit earlier on in the year. But as the 2 years that I've done the West Arnhem Way, I haven't hammered the Highland Sling. I've run it at a decent lick, but I haven't gone as hard as I possibly could at all. I haven't raced it, because I finished it, and I know that within 2 weeks of that, I want to get back to training and have another little cycle of decent training before I then have a taper for the West Arnhem Way. So the February, March, beginning of April, leads me into the Highland Sling. Then I've got a little bit of recovery, enough to do. I'll talk about what I would call a cycle of training in a second. So I get one cycle of training done, and then I'm tapering to the West Arnhem Way. And that way, I'm not super, super fit in March. I'll actually be fit when I want to be in June.
Okay, and this cycle of training then, how does that work?
Yeah. I have this kind of mantra that goes around in my head when I plan all my training, which is you only get fitter when you're resting. You know, for those that perhaps don't know the physiology of it all, basically when you train, you actually damage your body. That's the whole point of training, that's what you're trying to do. And then depending what you've done, when you're resting and recovering, your body basically repairs itself, often a little bit stronger, and that's how the body adapts to training, and that's how you get fitter. But the, you know, probably 10, 15 years ago, when I look back now, I was probably running too much and not resting enough. And maybe I'm just a bit older, a bit wiser, I don't know. But now I realise that my body needs the recovery time in order to get the best out of itself. So what I do, I have easy, medium and hard weeks of training. So an easy week might be just 4 or 5 sessions. A medium week will be 5 or 6 sessions, and a hard week will be 6 or 7 sessions. And early on in the year, I'll be doing, you know, easy, easy, medium, medium, easy, easy, medium. I'm just start off on those lower levels, and then once I get back
in. Sorry, is that in the December, January time?
Yeah. I'll still. There won't be many weeks when I'll run 7 times in the week through December and January. Over the Christmas holidays, I'll probably do a bit more, just because I've got the time. But I send many more easy and medium weeks. That's not necessarily how hard I'm running or how the distance I'm running. It's just how many times in the week I run.
Yeah.
That's what I work on more. I don't really measure distances much, because I'm running off road all the time, so it's quite depressing. I tend to stick with how many hours I'm doing and how many sessions in a week I do. And then over the Christmas holidays, I'll probably crank it up to doing probably running every day over the holidays, just because I've got a bit more lunch and a bit more time. But then once I'm into the new year, it generally goes easy week, medium week, hard week, easy week, medium week, hard week, and I rotate like that. And the one time, later on, I might do a couple of medium weeks back to back, and then followed by a hard week. So then it becomes a 4-week cycle: easy, medium, medium, hard. The one thing I don't do at any point is do 2 hard weeks back to back, because my 45-year-old body can't take that anymore. I'll always follow a hard week with an easy one. Rather than going, I just feel that little cycle gives me more room to adapt and more room to play with it. And if I've got a particularly tough week at work, which everybody has at some point, I can stack the week. If I know the beginning of the week's going to be particularly hard, then I'll make sure that those recovery sessions, or sorry, the days that I'm not running, I'll do those at that time. And I'll back stack the week and do the other sessions later on the week, or vice versa. So I couldn't tell you what days I'm going to do each of the sessions on. I know some runners like yourself, Guy, I know you have, you know, Monday nights to start late night and so on. It's kind of more set in concrete. I tend to just work around what time I've got. So on Sunday night, I'll probably think, right, I'll do that run on Monday. Tuesday, I've got a football six, I've got a football match to referee, so I won't train that night. I'll be able to do that session on Wednesday, and so on. I just work the week out that way.
No, that's really helpful. And I think those, say for example, let's just go back to thinking about, say, December, and sort of that early time. I know a number of people quite like to do the Markathon, you know, where they run every day in December, to give them a bit of a base. Would that be something that you would say that's a good idea, or do you think people need to be getting some rest days?
I personally don't. I'd love to get involved with it, and I think it's a good idea, but I know it wouldn't work for me. I know it would be, that early on, it would probably, I'll either get too sick too soon, or I'll get injured before I've built up my base. But I think it's a great motivating tool. It's a really great idea. I would maybe, if I was advising somebody who's giving that a go for the first time, I would, you know, when I'm having a complete rest day, then I would just say to them, well, make sure that is whatever the minimum 3 miles or whatever the minimum distance is, you know, run that at a ridiculously slow pace. So it essentially becomes, you're shaking your legs, but you're not really stressing them. You're not doing any more damage to them. And that'll work fine. You're getting some nice fresh blood into the muscles. You know, those kind of recovery runs are very useful. I mean, that's what I'm actually doing at the moment. I'm just working on basically all my runs at the moment, recovery runs, just getting ready for, you know, another 3 or 4 weeks' time when I'm ready to start my training for next year.
Yeah. And just another thought I had was, another question was, again, you've said it's important to have this easy build-up, but I know some people are dying to get out in December and do a 30-mile run. Is that something you would encourage, or do you think people should wait to do that before they start doing the longer runs?
Well, for me personally, yeah, I get out and do long runs. I'll be doing long runs in December and January, definitely. But it's all about the pace you're doing them and what you've done immediately prior to it and immediately after it. So I'll make sure in December and January I'm building up. I'll make sure I have a couple of easy days leading into the run and a couple of easy days after the run, maybe even not running at all. But I'll be going out and doing 30 milers, definitely.
Right.
But I think I tend to, a phrase I've used before, John, I just call them smell the roses runs. And there won't be many roses out there, but that's why we do. But, you know, it just go along and stop and take photographs and hike a bit. You know, it doesn't matter. It's just getting some time on the feet is a really good idea. I've trained for the West Arden Way 3 times. One year I didn't do it when I was injured. But I always started my winter training with a sort of increase the mojo run. So I'd go up in just before Christmas and I'd have a 30 mile run on the West Arden Way, usually with snow and ice everywhere, and just put some micro spikes on and just have a really absolute blast on the route, take photographs. You know, stopping with minor views, and it doesn't really matter how long you take to do it. It just, you know, it's quite, you need to get on the route as well.
Yeah, excellent. And finally, have you got any final tips that you'd give, maybe particularly to those that are entering the race for the first time at this stage of their training?
for the training, I would, if we're talking about this whole periodization thing about, you know, going from November through till June, I would suggest that try and plan maybe once a month of getting on the route. Put that in, and that's what I've actually sitting in front of me now is my plan for this year going through, well, December's not on, but going through to the race now. And in big red letters on certain weekends, it just says WHW. And I just tried to plan at least once a month going up and running sections of the route, partly because it's just a great route, partly because it's great for your motivation to know something like that's coming up again, and you can mix your easy, medium, hard weeks around those training runs. But also, and maybe we can talk about this another time in the actual, like, how you actually go about running the race, I need to know what's coming up and when it's coming up. There's no problems with navigation on the West Garden Way. It's really well marked. That won't be an issue. But you need to know, you know, when's the next hill coming? How long is it going to take me to get me to that next checkpoint when I can see my crew? When's this long downhill bit coming that I've got to save my quads for? All those little things. Where's this rough section when I know everybody's going to be struggling over it, so I don't get wound up or don't get frustrated? Because, you know, all those little things. You don't want, there's enough things can go wrong on the day as it is. You don't want the course to be another one of them. So go and learn the route.
Yeah, excellent. Well, thank you very much. I think we'll do these regularly, once every couple of months or so, and we can look at things like speed work, things like hills, back to back runs, pacing. There's a whole area, and I might well put something on Facebook as well and see if we can get some questions for you, maybe some questions that people would particularly like answering. But thanks for giving your time tonight, and we'll look forward to doing these regularly over between now and the race in June.
Lovely. Look forward to next time, Joe.
Okay, thank you. I hope you've enjoyed this episode of the West Highland Way Race podcast. Sorry about the recording there with Dave. The wasn't a great quality on the Skype, I'm afraid. So hopefully next time we do that, we'll either be able to coincide when Dave's up, or we do it over a better connection. Anyway, I hope you got the gist of it and were able to follow what Dave was saying there. So that's the end of this podcast. I'll say in a few weeks' time, I'll be interviewing John Vernon, who has done 10 West Highland Way races. So it'll be interesting to get his perspective on running the West Highland Way race and other races as well over the last number of years. And as I've been trying to do, just finishing off with a quote of the day. This again comes from Wombat Fitness. And this is a quote from Sir John Marks Templeton. He says, "The person who really wants to do something finds a way. The other finds an excuse."